We managed to rescue close to 15,000 records, all lying in chor bazaars, raddi shops.
How did you rescue them?
Go physically place to place.
Buy them?
Buy them, yeah, with the money that was given. Sometimes some people donated, some I bought. It was like literally I was the glorified raddiwala myself. Mind you, in Delhi, in Chandni Chowk, if you go to that area, there are lots of raddiwalas and you'll find thousands and thousands of records even now. And that's where I found this record of Gandhi, which is probably the only record he made on a gramophone disc. Gandhi's spiritual message or something like that. That's the name of the record. That's there. The Laut archive had about 200 records of Indian prisoners of war of the First World War, Gohar Jan. And she was a visiting musician at the Mysore Palace. It was very sad that this was surely a diva of her times who had come to such poverty and penury and that she died so lonely, nobody by her bedside to shed tears for her. And I even went to the KR hospital masquerading as her grandson to find her death certificate, which I actually found and I put it in that book, the Sehgal and the Devika Rani, that era.
The KL Sehgal. Yes. I only know him from Delhi Belly because they sample his voice in Sehgal Blues.
Yes.
The song, yeah. Yo, what is up, my friends? Welcome to another episode of Dostcast. My name is Vinamra Kasana and I love music. In college, I used to run a music venue for about 2 years where we would host bands from Berklee College of Music. And I had lots of records and I played the guitar myself, sang. Overall, I'm always very interested in the history of music and playing music. And my favorite music documentary, my favorite music series is called Vinyl on HBO. I have a deep, deep, deep love for ethnomusicology, which is a term I recently learned because today's guest is Dr. Vikram Sampath. Usually you know him as a pretty serious historian, but in this conversation, we spoke about something. His project that will probably blow your mind. It's called the Archive of Indian Music. This Archive of Indian Music has 450,000 followers on SoundCloud. Drake has 3.24 million. Everyone has heard of Drake. No one has heard of this archive. But it's a testament to the fact that Vikram has spent years composing and collecting old gramophone records from across India and abroad, buying them, digitizing them, and making available the various kinds of music and sounds from India all the way up till the 1960s, ranging all the way back till the early 1900s. So this is music from 60 years and beyond, all available to you free of cost on SoundCloud. And we discussed the fascinating history of Indian music, classical music. We discussed how music, how India's first pop stars came to be in the 1920s, how most of these pop stars were courtesans who couldn't be concerned too much about shame or reputation and were bold enough to just sing. And this is an unlikely conversation from an unlikely person. And I hope your response is clicking the button in the link and opening the archive and getting access to 5,000 or 6,000 plus tracks from all kinds of music in India that you've never heard. This musical conversation with, I know that sounds very cheesy, but this musical conversation with Dr. Vikram Sampath. By the way, did I also mention he's got a doctorate in music? He's got a doctorate in ethnomusicology and history. So he's got all the historical underpinnings for every single music track that we discuss in the conversation. Now, the conversation with Dr. Vikram Sampath begins in 3, 2, 1. So, you know, I discovered Archive of Indian Music after looking you up. Then I realized you had a doctorate in musicology.
And history,
right? I haven't come across too many musicologists in my life. My only experience of musicology, is that the right word? Musicology?
No, it's actually ethnomusicology.
Ethnomusicology, my apologies.
Yeah, yeah. Musicology would actually be getting into the nuances of the music itself.
Okay.
This is more of the cultural and historical, social aspects related to music. Culture. Amazing. And consumption.
Amazing. So when I was in the US, we had a library called the Mugar Memorial Library in my college. And they had a separate musicology room, which didn't have any of the records that I would typically want to listen to because I used to own a record player back in college. So I would go to record stores and speak with these crate digger record guys who would then help me pick up records. So I would not pick up standard run-of-the-mill records, but they would help me identify some records. Because of that, I was able to get into Billie Holiday, Duke Ellington, this whole, you know, beautiful blues and jazz scene in the US. And then I think I was writing a paper on Billie Holiday. Oh. So I, through that, I learned about how her song Strange Fruit is actually a reference to the hangings of African-American slaves on the trees that they did in the South. Wow. So the lyrics are strange fruit hanging on the poplar tree, right? And so I realized that there is a whole like field where people study, I guess, what is ethnomusicology. And of course, when I was reading your bio for the other interview we just wrapped up, I got intrigued. But you have done your doctorate in ethnomusicology around Indian classical music?
Yes.
Yeah. What does that entail exactly?
So I'll just give you a little backstory to that before getting there. So it's the 16th year of my literary career, where in 2008 was when my first book on the history of the Mysore royal family called Splendors of Royal Mysore came out. That's a different story in itself as to how and why. That for another podcast. But, you know, while researching on that, by chance, you know, I came across this lady's mention called Gohar Jan. And she was a visiting musician at the Mysore Palace, and she died there in 1930. And it was a thin file of some of the letters. And it said she was the first gramophone celebrity of India to ever record in the subcontinent, and that she was born of a Hindu grandmother, an Armenian Christian father, a British grandfather, and she was in fact baptized at the Holy Trinity Church in Allahabad, and then later converted to Islam and became mother and daughter. Mother was Badi Malka Jan, and this lady was Gohar Jan, and they went to Banaras where they changed their religion and became tawaifs or courtesans, and became courtesans in the court of Nawab Wajid Ali Shah. And at the turn of the century, 20th century, when we had recording technology come from abroad, from Europe, from you know, London, from Paris, Germany, she was the first artist to record. So there were probably three lines or four lines of her biographical details that were there in the Mysore Palace archives. And something in me turned and I said, this seems like such a fascinating story that is just dying to be told. And I decided almost on an impulse there that I need to tell Gohar Jan's story. Now, usually I take decisions on an impulse. Most often I regret, but this was sadly, fortunately one where I did not have to regret, because I didn't know how to go about the research here, to be frank. I had by chance come across a person at the place of their death, you know, in Mysore, where she died in 1930. She'd lived there for 2 years. And, you know, those letters there, there were a few letters where she's pleading for help from the Maharaja's government. Don't cut my income tax and increase my salary. And then she dies mysteriously in the KR hospital there in Mysore. And there are people claiming a baker, a confectioner, a maid, saying she owned 2 annas to me, 4 rupees to me. And they're all making claims to the Maharaja's government. And it was very sad that this was surely a diva of her times who had come to such, you know, poverty and penury. Yeah. And that she died so lonely with nobody by her bedside to shed tears for her. And to be honest, I mean, I even went to the KR hospital masquerading as her grandson to find her death certificate, which I actually found, and I put it in that book. My name is
Gohar Jan. What was the cause of death?
It was unknown. That's what has been mentioned there. The date and other things were mentioned, but it was left unknown reasons for death. So maybe she committed her own death or whatever, because she died when she was 57. So it was not such a ripe old age to die. And then I even went again as a grandson to the to find her, her tomb. Because I also wanted to know where the first gramophone celebrity of this country, recorded artist, lay. And there was a Kabristan committee in Mysore, and that Maulvi who came along with me to show this, that side is all the pre-independence graves. And so we went all over the place searching grave to grave if the epitaph had any details, but unfortunately it didn't.
You couldn't find the grave?
No. So the first...
What do you tell your family and friends when you go about these excursions? Because you've been, you know, what's the right word? Like the gods of the muse have possessed you, so now you must pursue it.
I think they before nobody used to understand my madness. And at that time when I was doing this Goharjan and Mysore book, I was in a regular corporate job.
Mm-hmm.
I was with Citibank and GE Money and Hewlett Packard and all these. And my colleagues and, you know, including my bosses in those review meetings, they said, why are you doing all this? I mean, every weekend would mean going away on research trips, going on loss of pay, extended leaves, when the whole, there's a team outing to some resort or some film show and this and that, I'm rummaging through graves to look for Gorjan's grave. The motivation nobody understood. Today, a lot of them write to me saying, my God, you've made something else of your life while we are still stuck in the same corporate rut. So hopefully they understand the things now. But it was a different, I think a calling was coming from somewhere else. So Gorjan, so I literally chased her through the length and breadth of India and even outside India over the next 4 or 5 years. That research took me 4 or 5 years after that. From Azamgarh, where she was born, to Banaras, where she converted to Islam, to Calcutta, where she lived. She was always called Gorjan Kalkatte Wali. So Calcutta had a lot of information to give. Then Mysore, Madras, Bombay, all places, Darbhanga, Rampur, wherever she lived significant periods of time. And also outside India. So I went to London and Berlin.
You were pursuing this single-handedly, yes. Dropping everything else.
Yes, yes. Self-financed.
After this book, after this leaflet or a book that you found that was this thin,
yes,
you decided to dedicate your life to searching for this lost star. Whose voice had you listened to by that point? Had you listened to some music or no?
Yeah, after coming back, then I started Googling about her, then seeing if there
after were, after financing the trip, you Googled.
Yes, yes. So like in Berlin, so interestingly, there was this gentleman who came to record her, Frederick William Gaisberg, who was a German agent, a recording agent from the Gramophone Company of London, who came all over the world on expeditions. They were also called recording expeditions. Just like in the Middle Ages, you used to go on expeditions to discover new lands. This man was coming to discover new voices. And so they knew nothing of the local music. They just saw whoever was commercially viable, they would record them. And the interesting part was when recording technology came to India, all over India, north, south, east, west, it was women who embraced it. We, the great men, we stayed away from it. There were lots of, inhibitions, superstitions that if you record into that evil English instrument, you will lose your voice, the gods will be displeased and all of that. So truly the grit and ingenuity of these women who negotiated their terms also. Gorjan managed to negotiate about 3,000 rupees for one recording session, which was like a princely sum those days. 1902, we are talking about. And that made them superstars because they just became overnight, wealthy to the brim. And there were so many apocryphal stories about her. She would go on her ghoda gadi, in the Eden Gardens and the entire Maidan area in Calcutta. And for that, once the Viceroy's cavalcade crosses her and she's fair-skinned, Armenian, converted. So he thinks, and she always wore fantastic jewelry and goggles and all of that. And he thought she was the Maharani of some Riyasat and doffed his hat or something to her. She also acknowledged him and drove away, apparently. And later he realized that she was a courtesan and then summoned her. And she was to pay a fine because it was a crime for common Indians to drive ghoda gadis of that.
Really?
Phaetons.
But she was so rich she could pay the fine.
She paid a fine every day. Of 1,000 rupees, apparently.
Was she the first pop star?
Yes, pop star, exactly.
No, but then the issue is like, who was listening to her? Because Indians couldn't afford gramophones, assuming.
No, not at all. They were 250 rupees was the cost of the machine, but those discs were probably much lesser. And so there were community gramophone listening sessions.
Right, like the same way they have the early days of the TV when one family has a TV and everyone else comes and watches it.
Yeah. And these were till then, especially classical music, concerts and soirees. They were only for the rich and the, at least in North India, in Southern India, in temples, because temples were still around. The temple economy and culture we were talking about in the previous discussion, where it's not just worship, but also concerts, everything happening. It was accessible. But in Northern India, North is a very, it's a euphemism for all of Eastern India, everything. There, It was only in zamindars' houses or in, you know, nawabs, and you could listen to music, classical music. So for a common man to even be able to hear Gauhar Jaan's voice sitting in the confines of a community gathering of near their house was a big deal, because they never could dream to enter her soiree. So that democratized music. It made them so rich. So Gauhar Jaan's photographs began to appear on matchboxes made in Austria. you still have in that book, I have put photographs of made in Austria with her picture on it. And she started earning so much properties, you know, all over Calcutta. And not only her, several other women. There were Janki Bai of Allahabad, Zohra Bai Agrewali, Malika Jaan of Agra.
And you have Zohra Bai's music on your SoundCloud, which, by the way, for listeners and viewers, has 450,000 followers. You've got Zohra Bai's recordings on the Archive of Indian Music, right?
Yeah. I'll tell a little more about how the Archive of Indian...
Okay, sure.
This was a long backstory, which I think sets a context as to why that is important. So this was Gauhar Jaan and her very, very fascinating life. Now, while going through the research, as you rightly asked then, that I really wanted to hear her voice. And being a student of classical music myself, I've trained in Carnatic classical vocal for about 20-25 years myself. So I was very keen to also analyze her music. But you don't find those machines, the gramophone records, or the players.
Sorry, I have a very minor interruption, which is, you know, like I see that Chinese parents often force their kids to learn the piano. Well, when you learn classical music vocals, is it out of just joy, or did your parents put you up to it?
No. Actually, I think I was put into music when I was 4 or 5 years old. Initially, it was a little coercion because, but my parents and my maternal grandmother, they apparently noticed that all the jingles and all of that that came on television, or the bhajans and things that were playing at home. I come from a mixed parentage, my Maharashtrian maternal side and a Tamilian paternal side. So, but living in Bangalore, so South India, MS Subbalakshmi, her Venkatesh Suprabhatam and all the bhajans keep playing. So I could just apparently listen to that and immediately reproduce it with a lot of fidelity. So my grandmother, God bless, decided that why not put him into music training so that he hones this skill. So initially at 5 years, 6 years of age, to actually go to a music class which ate into my playtime, it was horrendous and a lot of crying and protest. But I think the protest lasted for a month or two. Once the bug caught me, I think it was a different, you know, just got so carried away by it. And I trained out of complete interest thereafter, with almost a desire to become a performing musician. I used to give performances here and there, on and off, but yeah, I think destiny had other plans, thankfully. so and I had the opportunity to learn under some very, very eminent gurus, for which I'm so grateful. Vidwan D.B. Nagaraj in Bangalore, but later Srimati Bombay Jayashri, and also Dr. Jayanti Kumaresh. So today I do them a lot of disservice by even telling that I'm their student, because I'm not a performing,
not practicing anymore. Yeah.
But then I think my contribution to music has been beyond just performance, which becomes a very individual-centric, you know, action. So I wanted to listen to Gauhar Jaan's voice. And so I realized then that that was another alley I was entering, which is this whole thing of this, you know, recorded sound of the past and how its access is so limited in this country. As I said, these gramophone players are not available. The needle that goes around 78 RPM shellac discs, that is no longer manufactured, or it's very difficult to get. So most of us may have had these machines, those crank machines, right? You crank it up and then there's that gleaming horn that comes and people are listening to it. So that most of our grandparents may have had it, but then we've given it away to the Raddiwala or the Chor Bazaar or something. So that's where they lie. And I managed to get a few of Gauhar Jaan's records, listen to her. And the best part was, you know, these recordings were only of 3-minute duration in that era, the early era, because that was the space that the record could carry.
Right.
So if you, or those of the listeners, know about classical music, Indian classical music, one raag alap you can do for through 3 hours. Those days it was all night concerts, one rag. In such a scenario, for these women to actually come up with this formula that in 3 minutes I'm going to concise, like pressy writing in literature, to just quickly show you the capsule that all the important ingredients are there and it should be sellable also. To do that was a huge thing.
And was there an ecosystem for like record companies and A&R agents and all of those things that we have today?
No, today I think most of them are all gone because I think gramophone company itself got
over. You know, like how in the music business you've got talent managers and like music companies who who publish the gramophone. Yes.
So those days they were. So,
okay.
So most of these women, Gauhar Jaan was educated, but there were other people who were not. The other women. So they would have agents who would bargain on their behalf for higher salary, fees structure. Then the company itself. So there were the Pathé company from France. There was Odeon from Germany. There was a gramophone company from London. So it's an establishment of a multinational network of music consumption.
And this is what era?
Early 20th century.
Early 20th century.
1902 to 1920, 30. And by then you had the First World War. So most of Europe markets got destroyed. And then India became one of the mainstays for the international recording business and started contributing more and more to the profitability of the gramophone company, which later became EMI.
Okay, the famous EMI group. Okay,
yeah, EMI, which is still around. And then taken over later, I mean, the Indian version now is Saregama. So the different things which come to this day have their roots into Gauhar Jaan entering that rudimentary studio. And I think that is another fascinating story in itself, which when you hear these voices, they didn't have mics then like this. It was the era of acoustic recording or mechanical recording, not electric recording, with mics to amplify your voice.
Okay.
So there was one horn. So like a table like this, the artist and the accompanying, you know, tabla, harmonium, they would be asked to jump onto it. And there would be a horn on the wall. And this artist had to crane his or her head into that horn and scream as loudly as you could. And depending on how loudly you scream, there was a stylus on the other end which would vibrate and cut those etches on a master shellac disc. Now, so it was a horrendous contraption.
So you could all these things solo. Like if you wanted to sing a duet, you would not both...
You could not. So that's why in these early recordings, you can hear the accompanying instruments only very, very faintly.
Yes.
They don't get the amplification.
And you hear a lot of noise as well.
Noise, yeah. Whereas all those things got eliminated in 1925 when electric recording and this mass marvel, the mic which we take so much for granted today, every time I look at it, there's a lot of reverence because I know what preceded this. And these ladies had to crane their head and scream and shout and this and in that sort of a thing. And in 3 minutes, you don't know, sometimes recordings, Gauhar was very, very clever businesswoman, but also artistically very clever. I don't know how she kept the time, like at 2 minutes 50 seconds, you have to finish. Otherwise, it just trails off. The shellac gets over, there's no retake.
Okay.
There's only one recording.
And you pay 3,000 rupees in 1902.
Yeah.
So it's a lot.
Lot. So they will not allow you to mess up the recording. So you have to be very accurate the first time, no retakes possible. So in that, you have to do all your taans, sargams. And imagine, and you know, Indian musicians, if you have seen, while classical musicians, they tend to move their hands, this thing takes over, right? And then the audio quality, the acoustic energy will not get focused into it. So there would be two agents who would hold your hands, one who would hold your head and push you inside that horn and ask you to bellow harder, you know.
So you can't even be ecstatic and sing at your own pace and relax into it.
Yes. And so most of these women who came there, they came all, they thought it was another mujra that they had, mehfil. And so they came dressed in all their beautiful jewelry and great, attire. Little did they realize that it was only a dark horn that was looking at them and not any audience. And so they...
But did this not compromise the audio? The, for example, if I'm singing at a lower decibel, I don't know the exact words, right?
Pitch.
If I'm singing at a lower pitch, I'm relaxed, right? I do know of one experiment. There's a song, obviously you're from the Indian classical side. I've listened to heavy rock, blues, jazz from America and the British, Britpunk, Britrock, all of that. David Bowie did this experiment where in a song called Heroes, his engineer placed a mic That was 6 inches away,
yeah,
6 feet away, and yeah, 60 feet away. That was the famous thing.
Correct.
So in all three verses, he's seen as screaming louder and heard as screaming louder and louder and louder.
Yeah.
Because he's trying to project to the mic 60 feet away as well.
Yeah.
That's when I actually could hear a musician really trying beyond having a natural gift and having, you know, and increasing your skill via practice.
The voice throw. So,
yeah.
I mean, for the Indian musicians, maybe it was very easy because the mehfils, the large mehfils that they used to have.
With no mics.
Without mics. And naturally, that voice throw, they could do it. But to be doing this in this sanitized, very terrible, I mean, imagine what it would do to the creativity of the artist to be screaming into that horn. And maybe that's also one reason the men did not want to participate in this affair. Mm. And they thought it's a compromise on classicism. It's a compromise on the quality. And, you know, your voice sounds so terrible that people are going to remember you for that.
But the recordings sound lovely. They don't sound terrible at all.
Yeah, but maybe for how we look at it now, maybe contemporarily, many people thought, oh my God, I sing so well. Look at this horrible recording of mine. And that's what people are going to remember me as 200 years from now. So many apprehensions may have kept the men away.
State purist, basically.
Many of them. A few participated, but majority were women. And they were all from the Tawayef and the Devdasi community, like Chutzpah, to give it back and, you know, go ahead with it. But once the men started seeing that what it did to the women's lives, they started earning so much. They became such pop stars and celebrities. And the gramophone company, whatever sold, they were there just for the commerce. They didn't care whether it was apples or oranges. Anything that sold, they recorded more. So if a Goharjan sold well, there would be exclusive sessions, Goharjan recording sessions, and different color labels used to be, like a violet label, purple label, that meant it was a superstar's recording. Similarly, in South India, you had this lady called Coimbatore Thai, who again had a violet label records, separate sessions dedicated only to her recording. And 200, 300, and Goharjan in her life recorded 600 records in about 15 languages, which included everything, you know, from South Indian languages, Persian, Sanskrit,
Arabic. She could
Arabic.
Speak all of those, or did she
Many
just...
of them, yeah, she did. She came from a multi-ethnic background herself.
That's crazy.
So, so it was very fascinating to see all of this and to hear those, rudimentary records. So few seconds at the end, 15 seconds, they had to keep to announce their names. She also at the end, she announces, my name is Goharjan. And that's why my book is called the same thing. My name is Goharjan, not for any other reason. And there was a technical reason for that the recordings were made in India, in Indian cities, but the manufacture was done in Hanover in Germany. So the master shellac would be recorded here and shipped all the way to Germany. And for the technician there, it was an anonymous voice. So he would listen to the whole record, identify the artist by this announcement, and then stamp, multiple copies would be done, and the labels would be stamped over it and sent back to India for sales. So see the clockwork precision. 3 minutes may, you have to keep that last 15 seconds to announce the name and all of that. And then the improvisation part, the compositional part, everything coming into clockwork precision in that. And we've lost all that treasure. So I was looking for this and so on. And of course, for the book, the limited version was done of her story. And the book also came with a CD, you know, of her songs and all of that, which I had got digitized in a very rudimentary way. But later on, when I got a fellowship and went to the Wissenschaftskolleg, the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin, and keeping Berlin as the base, I went to almost all the sound archives in Europe.
And Berlin is the capital of world music in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So Berlin, Vienna, Paris, London. And I was astonished to see that almost all these places had a national sound archive. And the second astonishment was that a lot of them had large holdings of Indian recordings, and not necessarily only of music, also voices, fascinating voices. For instance, in Berlin, there is an archive called the Laut Archive, which had about 200 records of Indian prisoners of war of the First World War.
In Germany?
In Germany, yeah.
And what are they saying?
So they were just, asked to say anything in their native language. So from Tamil to Bengali to Pashto to, Sindhi to Punjabi.
Could you make out some of the things that they said?
No, it was easy to do that because they would be, kuch chutkula sunao, kuch aur apne bhasha mein kuch sunao, something they would... So now, and then at the Germans being Germans, for these every three minute recording, there would be a 40 page documentation where who this fellow was, which village he came from, what is his father's name, where did he study, all his personal details. Then what all he spoke had to be, he was asked to write it down in his native language if he knew how to read and write. And then that would be translated and transliterated into German. So such a elaborate on some inconsequential, some Sheikh Chilli ki kahani, something like that, some fellow has this thing that has 20-30 pages of documentation saying what this whole damn thing was. And then there were voices of leaders. When Rabindranath Tagore went to the Berlin University and gave a talk there, that recording was there. Then Lala Hardayal, who founded the Gadar Party, he operated in Germany for some time, so his voice recording was there in this Laut archive. And several other such things. There was this phonogram archive in Vienna where the cylindrical recording, that's a different technology, the cylinders, wax cylinders, Edison's cylinders, which was slightly before the gramophone era.
And they can still record music?
No, now it's, I think, out of this thing. But that was more like a portable device. So field recordings used to be done with the wax cylinders, okay. Non-commercial field recordings. So people would go to some village. Whereas here, the Gauharjan and artists had to come to a set-up studio. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, the field recorder could go to village and record it. And that was not for commercial purpose, but more for documentation. Mm-hmm. So some mother singing lullaby to her child, some way priest chanting something in Madras, things like this. So Vienna Phonogram Archive had so many of those things from India of 1890s, 1900s. 1905. And the one constant question everybody kept asking me there was, doesn't India have a national sound archive? And, as a student of music, as a student of history, and more so as an Indian, I think it was deeply embarrassing for me to tell them that, no, we don't have one such institution.
Well, we must have some kind of a archive of important songs or famous songs from after the time of our independence that maybe went platinum or like what, chart busters?
Yeah, pre-post independence lot. No, but there's no such institution in India at all. You have the National Film Archives in Pune, but a National Sound Archive for recordings which predate the advent of films, we don't have in India. And so for the longest time, so I'd learnt a lot of the technology of the digitization, how it's done.
How would you do it? Which is the real question, because So, the record player I had also had an option to convert the record into a Bluetooth file. Convert the record to an MP3 file, not a WAV file exactly, but an MP3 file that I could then transfer using Bluetooth.
Yeah, it had
that feature.
Correct. So after coming back, this was 2012-13 that I'm talking about, 2011-12, almost 13 years ago. That was when I tried with the, previous government of India saying, we need to establish a national sound archive and I'll help you do this. But the government, never shows any interest in most things. And so that was when, by chance, I met Mr. T.V. Mohandas Pai, who was then with Infosys. And he said, why you want to run behind all these stupid governments? So you start something of your own and I'll provide the initial seed capital for it. And so with that, in 2011, I established the Archive of Indian Music. It's probably India's first digital sound archive for vintage gramophone records. And since then to now, and we imported all the machines required for high fidelity sound transfer from America, from Europe and other places. And it was a small scale venture, which a technician was there doing this. And I also realized that there's no point keeping it to myself because it's not my property. It's somebody has recorded, somebody has sung and performed. Who am I to this thing? So we managed to rescue close to 15,000 records, all lying in chor bazaars, Raddi shops.
How did you rescue them?
Go physically place to place.
Buy them.
Yeah, with the money that was given. Sometimes some people donated, some I bought. It was like literally I was the glorified Raddiwala myself.
So where did you keep all of these?
So we had a space then which Mr. Pai had given to us.
Okay, and you had 15,000 records
there. We still do.
You still have all these records?
Yeah. And these range from classical Hindustani and Carnatic music, also folk music from various parts of India. Theatre recordings, very interestingly, of the Marathi Natya Sangeet, Bal Gandharva, Master Krishna Rao and all that.
And that's the only source of these recordings?
Yes.
Anywhere in the world?
Probably. Bengali theatre, Tamil theatre, Telugu theatre, then also early cinema, the Saigal and the Devika Rani, that era.
K.L. Saigal. Yes. Yeah, I only know him from Delhi Belly because they sample his voice in Saigal Blues.
Yes.
The song, yeah.
And the other, Indian languages and voices of leaders like Gandhi's voice, Tagore's voice, Subhash Chandra Bose's speech from Tokyo. And mind you, in Delhi, in Chandni Chowk, if you go to that area, there are lots of Raddiwalas. And you'll find thousands and thousands of records even now. And that's where I found this record of Gandhi, which is probably the only record he made on a gramophone disc. He gave a lot of radio broadcasts, but on gramophone disc, that was the only record. When he went to the roundtable conference or so, he was asked to say something. Mm-hmm. He said, I will not talk about politics. I will talk about spirituality. And so he spoke about his conception of God. And so Gandhi's spiritual message or something like that, that's the name of the record. And that's there, and it was found in Chandni Chowk under a heap of other records. And the fellow was, literally sitting on them, one putting their feet on another, this thing. So that is how these records languish, with none of us even bothering as to how to rescue them, how to preserve them, digitize them, governments. Nobody takes initiative or interest in doing any of this. So what we've done is probably a very small fraction of the restoration, but at least it creates every extant record cannot be rescued and protected, but at least a prototype,
And how does it have so many followers? How does, like...
I don't know. We have, we were talking earlier...
Don't promote it at all?
Not promoted it at all. This is probably the first podcast I'm even talking in such detail about this archive and the long backstory as to how it came, what was the inspiration and so on. The inspiration was that serendipitous afternoon in the Mysore Palace archive, where by chance I came across that box file of letters and Gohar Jan's reference there, which totally changed my life, I must say. So this digitization was done. But after that, my idea was there's no point keeping it in my hard disk. It should go out to the people at large. So one was to put it on SoundCloud free of cost. So on soundcloud.com, if you go to and type Archive of Indian Music, I think about 2,000 tracks or something are already uploaded there. Free of cost, all these different categories.
And so can I, for example, as a musician, go there and sample it in my stuff?
Yeah.
It's all public use?
Public use. It would be good if they write to me or something and take permission, at least give credits. I'm not even asking for it.
But that's great, because what you've basically done is there's all these new startups right now and music apps who basically create ethnic Indian sample packs.
Yeah.
Or they send a musician to the field and they do a bunch of field recordings, and then they compile all of those. Yeah. But if we can have indigenous sounds available to us, and there's rap, there's hip hop, there's rock, there's so many pop, there's so many genres.
Yeah.
If we can actually get an archive and parse through it like great diggers do,
dig
out the best samples that we want, give you the credit, you basically have access to more samples than you possibly would need. And you don't have to generate it through AI. Yeah. You don't have to. The other issue in most hip hop is that everyone uses the same samples because they're so less because people have to do the digging.
Correct.
But if there's an archive, you can just pick it up.
Correct. True. So the possibilities are, limitless. And so dissemination was something I was very keen on. And so those days, I'm still talking of the 2014, 16, that era, where I tried to make, quite unsuccessfully with, tied up with someone to make an app or so which people could download to access vintage music.
Mm-hmm.
Then we also tied up with the Google Cultural Institute to ensure that a lot of these were thematic exhibitions, online exhibitions. So if there's Women's Day, so why don't we have a series of all these pioneering women from different parts?
Zorabhai and the
others. Zorabhai, Janki Bhai, Salem Godavari, Bangalore, Nagaratnamma, many people all over India. And then Independence Day is coming. So patriotic songs on the gramophone and how the gramophone was used as a agency for anti-colonial
was
struggle.
Was it the only audio available to Indians at that point?
Perhaps. Probably even now.
No, I mean like at the time of the gramophone.
Yes, when that was only that was, technology.
You didn't have speakers, you didn't
No. By 1930s, you had the radio coming.
Okay.
So the radio, once electric recording came in 1925, the next outcome was the radio technology. So, but other than that, there was nothing. And gramophone, radio, both were interchangeably, used. And most often radio recordings got recorded on gramophones, gramophone discs. So they were almost complementary to each other. So the idea was, so with Google Cultural Institute, then we also for a brief while did exhibitions in various parts of India. I called these Voices of India. And we said, when you say exhibition, you always look at physical artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you look at audio as an artifact worth listening? So we had the physical structures, the photograph of the artist and some biodata or something. But each person was given an audio guide type of a thing where you could listen to the song of that person. And while you look at the person's face, you're also listening to it and walking around and so on. So that we did in a couple of cities, which was very, very successful. So that way, I think, and your question as to how it garnered about 4.5 lakh followers, I have no clue, because never aggressively promoted it, never spoken about it much. But I think there was a hunger for all matters history, whether it is books on history or even these vintage voices. It's just that it needs to be provided to people, and someone has to do the dirty work of literally getting into, getting your hands dirtied by getting into the field. And so that's how this archive of Indian music has still been, it still survives. We still have, in a very small, slow, soft way, there's a technician who digitizes something, puts up something, and every track I see gets so many plays. And some of the very, very vintage recordings that are there on the archive site for people, of course, there's Gauhar Jan's, the earliest recordings mm-hmm. of India from 1902. There's the first ever recording of Bharat Ratna M.S. Subbulakshmi as a 10-year-old child in 1926 that she sang. There's this only recording on the gramophone of Gandhi of Subhash Chandra Bose.
Anything very peculiar that you sort of laughed at or were like shocked by?
So there are some which I've put there of theatre recordings which are very, very funny. There's some Alfred Natak Company which has all these comic songs and men mimicking as women, and so one has to listen to that. I can't even
okay.
So those are really, that showed what the popular culture was in those
and
days.
You can't even find a historical account of this, because this is some very nondescript theater group who exists in this time.
Yeah, so part of my PhD work was exactly documenting the historical part also of that. So which was to find out who were these players and how did they contribute to the pop culture of the time. Because that what is today's pop culture was that day these Natak Mandalis and companies where people gathered as a community to enjoy. So who were these companies? Who were the players? How did the recording influence their art, and how did the art influence the recording company's success, its profitability, its reach, all of that. So it was a very, so that also, I mean, serendipity all through. So I was still, as I said, struggling and strutting through my corporate career, which I hated to the core as to why I was doing what I was doing. But, by chance, by then, 3 books of mine had already come out, and including this Gauhar Jan one, which, as I said, changed my life, the book which I thought no one's going to read. Why is anyone going to be interested in a Tawaif who died, 1930? That won me the Sahitya Academy Award. It won me an award in New York for the best researched work in history. And then I was giving lectures in several places. And by chance, I'd gone to Australia, to the University of Queensland, to give a talk about this. And luckily for me, in the audience were the heads of the schools of music and history who were sitting there. And they told me after the talk that, you know, you've done so much work on this. And there's so much of information across all of this. So why don't you put this all together in the form of a PhD? And we'll be happy to provide you an opportunity to do this. And I was very clear, I didn't want to do an honorary degree and all that. Really wanted to work my way through the rigors of academic research. How do you structure arguments, research, you know, questions, and learn historiographical research. So I said, no, I want to do this. And again, I was lucky in destiny, serendipity, you call it as you wish. There was an Indian professor of history, Professor Singhal, who had passed away there. And he had left behind a bequest for, you know, and this was to finance the PhD, you know, work of any Indian scholar who would come to that university to do his or her PhD in history.
That's very, very specific.
Indian and this. Yeah. And that bequest was expiring in the next 6-7 months or so. And they, the university was also, I think, desperate that they give it to some person. So lo and presto, the Indian scholar appeared and he found the bequest also. So it was such a wonderful turn of events and destiny that I didn't even have to spend anything for my PhD, you know, to do at the University of Queensland. Over the next 4 years that I spent there, you know, in doing this entire work, and already all the research that I had done, it was just to put it all together in a proper form of academic work. That was, I think, a very interesting experience, and that gave me the courage to also give up my job. Because the stipend that they were giving me as part of that bequest, I think it was far more than the salary I was drawing here.
As a full-time corporate guy who's supposed to make a lot of money.
Yeah, considering the, I think, foreign exchange currency differential, it was much more. And so I said, okay, now by then books started selling more and so on. So I still had the financial wherewithal. And this was after 9-10 years of struggling through corporate life. Then I decided to make the switch, but continued with the thing of, you know, keeping this archive alive, keeping the books coming through.
Yeah. What's the criteria for getting something in the archive? Because an archive, by definition, is supposed to contain older things or things you deem old.
Yeah. So here, I think, since it's an online archive, so the Indian Copyright Act says anything 60 years from the date of publication, it enters public realm, anything beyond that. So here, ideally, pre-1960.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So that means that you can basically have, because some of the more popular tracks on this are from Lata Mangeshkar.
Lata Mangeshkar. And all the Bollywood, Hindi.
But which makes me wonder that this is really at the start of a career, because after 60s, you know, Lata Mangeshkar becomes an icon for the next so many decades.
Yeah, those are very old recordings of hers where her voice texture is so different. Even Rafi, Mohammed Rafi and Asha Bhosle, everyone who's there, Manna Day, there's so many of those, you know, records on this archive, which is an older version. Yeah.
Wow, man. Has this led to some other interesting serendipitous discoveries around music? And the reason I say that is because, you know, Sneha Kanwalkar, the music composer, who's composed the music for Gangs of Wasseypur, obviously love her music.
Correct.
She went around India doing this show called Sound Trippin'. Mm-hmm. And even for Wasseypur, she went to different indigenous musicians of Bihar and UP and had them sort of sit in a studio and record stuff. So has this led you to also go and deliberately discover music? Because, you know, one of the things that I read on your dubious Wikipedia, let's just say, was the inquiry into the Baul tradition.
Yes. Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah.
And all I can remember from that, my very photographic memory, is Baul and Mystical in Bengal.
Ah, yes. So, yes, that's true. While I was doing this archive, suddenly this was again 2016 or so, where I thought, you know, these are gramophone records which are at the verge of extinction and which needed to be preserved. But beyond gramophone, there are other things also which are fast becoming extinct, which is our folk culture, what is indigenous culture. Initially, I thought of part of Bengal and also the Northeast. Very keen to do, because the Northeast indigenous communities there, almost 400 plus indigenous communities, wide diversity of language, dialects, the musical styles, music instruments, everything. Practitioners are giving up because there's no, you know, demand for the next generation and so on. So they all, I think in 50, 60 years, they'll all die, the musical forms.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought we should go there and do like what the wax cylinders did of a field recording. If we can do a documentation of a field recording, and that's what I was discussing with two other friends, one Rajiv Sarma, who's in Guwahati, who's quite knowledgeable about the Northeast, and another was three-time Grammy Award winner Ricky Cage, who's my school junior and a very dear friend from Bangalore.
Big heartfulness practitioner.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we decided then that let's not start initially with the Northeast. It may be very difficult. And Bengal and this Baul tradition too, though Baul is not at that verge of extinction as some of the Northeastern things. This was more of a pilot project we tried in 2016, where we set up a small team which actually went there. Now, you have two kinds of Bauls. One is the, you know, the Parvati Das Baul and others who come to cities, who perform in large, you know, auditoria and in music festivals and all that. But there are other, the Bauls are actually the mystic saints who have been from time immemorial, almost 1,000-1,500-year-old tradition of both the Bhakti, the Sufi, you know, Lallan, Fakir, and there were other, the Islamic, you know, Sufi elements too that came there, which form part of the now Bangladesh, you know, where it is practiced. The Hindu Baul traditions, most of them are sannyasis. They live in, the cremation grounds. It's a very mystic tradition. They don't deal with people. And it talks about esoteric stuff. It talks about finding the Moner Manush, or the man, the soul within. And that also inspired Tagore and Rabindra Sangeet to a large extent. So the inner journey and inner discovery of the divinity within and so on. That's the larger theme of the Baul Sangeet. So our teams went to Birbhum, the places around Bengal near where the Vishwabharati is, Tarapit, Birbhum, all these places. Stayed with those Bauls for several weeks, filmed them. And tried to understand the Baul culture, and we tried to string together a kind of a narrative to make our first documentary film called Who is Baul? And that is actually also freely available for people on YouTube to actually hear, and the beautiful music and also their culture. So that was something that was a pilot project. We were supposed to go from there to other communities in Northeast, and that actually still yet to happen. We also requested the government to help us because this costs a lot of money to
like a documentary crew, and research is pretty expensive.
It's a lot of work and a lot of resources needed. We didn't get too much help, and each of us got busy. I got busy in my own book writing, and after that Ricky has gone on to win two more Grammy Awards, so he got busy in something else. So I think it has been an aborted project, but hopefully it'll resurrect itself. But for now, at least we have one pilot to show, and it has done pretty well. It was screened in several international film festivals in the documentary section, and won a lot of critical acclaim that way. So it was a new vista to explore living traditions which are at the verge of death. And that's the beauty of India, I think, where when we look at our history, when we look at our culture, the very fact that we don't archive, the very fact that we are not a museum country, because whereas Europe, you have an entire museum mile, everyone is going to museums.
Almost every small city has a small museum.
Yes.
For sure.
But we are totally against it. And that's one reason, we are a living tradition. As we move around, as we speak, there is history to be seen. Everything is a museum. This country is a giant museum. It's not a fossilized piece you're going to go to a museum and then see and say, "Are wah, kya baat hai." So similarly, that's why I think this whole concept of archiving and documentation, when it came even to our music traditions, our ancestors didn't feel like doing it. And I remember it myself, because in my music classes 30, 40 years back when I started, my teacher would not let me record the class. you had to learn it, oral tradition, and imbibe it. Keep repeating it, quite like the Vedas and others are learned. Mm-hmm. You're not going
Do you think that's where the rote culture comes from in our country?
No, that's the better part of the rote culture, where you are internalizing what you're learning. Mm. You're through constant repetition, you're actually, whereas the rote culture would be if you record something and then listen to it and try to imitate it. Here you're listening to the guru and then trying to internalize it so much that it becomes a part of you. It's not rote would be something that is external, which you're trying to force fit into yourself. Here mm-hmm. the music learning too, like the Vedic teaching or learning, is all the time. I mean, how is it that, you know, the Vedic chants, when you listen to them, forget the words. Through centuries, even the intonation, even what goes up, what goes down, it's called udatta swara, anudatta swara, those are maintained exactly how it would have been, recited or heard 2,000, 3,000 years ago. And over centuries of invasions, when people came and broke down our temples or burnt our libraries, Nalanda, Takshashila, Vikramshila, how many brains could they kill? They had to kill like every living Indian to eradicate this knowledge. The library was here. The archive was here, mm-hmm. where they had learnt not only the words, but also the tone, the intonation of chanting. So when I hear a Vedic chant, for me, the religious part is one, and this thing, the archival, beauty of that, as an archivist and a historian, I have goosebumps even as I speak this, that, this is something that has survived so many centuries of every attempt to obliterate it. Isn't that so fascinating that, as I said, even the highs and lows, and how did our ancestors devise this mechanism to transmit knowledge in ones and zeros when there were no hard disks? What is this computer technology? Today we're talking about it, but how did these people transmit not just the text, but also the tone? So similarly, I think that's why they would always frown upon, don't record, don't this thing, make it a part of your existence, then it'll never go. And then you teach it in an oral Guru Shishya tradition. And so
okay,
Gurukul
is so big on apprenticeship culture here.
Yes, Gurukul system was so, and all these have been broken. We spoke about temple economy, which created a commercial, angle. Similarly, the Gurukul system, where this oral transmission from teacher to taught over generations happened, even that is gone. And we follow blindly the Western model of just, memorizing, mugging up mm-hmm. boring dates of history or, mathematical multiplication tables and all that. Whereas these people are able to chant verses and verses and verses without any problem. Now, even I remember the songs and the compositions that my teacher has taught me maybe 30 years ago. I don't need a book because it's become so much part of you. It's a fascinating way how the mind operates and how you're able to reproduce this knowledge. And I think that is the fundamental difference between why we shun the idea of archive, museum, all of that. While the West has that sort of a thing where everything needs to be written down, mm-hmm. everything needs to be physically seen. Whereas this is a living tradition. So, but then in today's world, you also need to see these things,
right.
And document it.
Yeah, I wouldn't know if I met like the successors of. Do you want more water? If I saw the successors of, Gohar Jan or a musician of that time, to then be able to find that person if they're still alive and yeah. then meet them, and then trust them as a reliable storyteller to exactly tell you the, not just about the life of that singer, that musician, but to also replay you that, because that's correct. Impossible. How can you?
Correct.
And so that'll be lost forever. But even now, if you search 1920s American music, you've got an entire genre of Americana yeah. music that's very well documented, recorded, has been replayed, how they sort of refashion it into a new form where they
yeah.
make period music now, but correct. It's all the new instruments, all the high fidelity stuff of today.
Correct.
That's only possible because they have those archives.
Correct. Yeah. True. So, yeah, I mean, whether it's, and I think that's one reason why only when you internalized it so much, maybe mm-hmm. it must have been tough for her, but she at least managed to make this 3-minute capsule.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so much a part of you, just to give a little part of that to the listener, maybe is much more simpler than if it is something very external to you. But the flip side for a modern historian who's looking into these things of the past is none of these people ever wrote or documented their experiences. How I wish Gaur Jan had a diary, or some of these other women had diaries where they said what were the challenges they faced yeah. as a musician, as an artist. They're the self-effacing world. And that's our problem even with history writing somewhere, philosophically speaking, where we are so self-effacing, where we say the individual is ephemeral. We're all going to die. We'll go into that Manikarnika Ghat in Varanasi one day. So what is all this? Why is my life story so important? The knowledge I create is important, much more important. So so Narayan Bhatt and all these people who resurrected the Kashi Vishwanath Mandir, you will have their volumes and treatises about some esoteric concepts. But who is Narayan Bhatt? Where was he born? What was his challenges in life? Who were his parents? Who were his children? Did he have a happy marriage? None of that we would know. Whereas the West would be the opposite.
Yeah,
if you go to Vienna, you'll go to,
Diary of Anne Frank, Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah,
all of people's intimate thoughts.
Correct. And you'll go to all the Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, their houses. You listen to, all their challenges. They would have documented everything because they felt they were as important, or probably more important than the art and the knowledge they created. Whereas in our Eastern philosophy, maybe Indic philosophy, it's the other way around.
We embrace the idea, not the individual.
Knowledge. So the music that she created was so important. The book that Narayan Bhatt wrote or some other scholar wrote was more important. But who was Gaur Jan? Who was Narayan Bhatt? Who was the other people? They said, no, it's not important.
How can we be very kind and make future historians' lives easy? Obviously, now we've got so much digital media. Like, I only wonder when my great, 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 great successors will see it. They will probably laugh at the... Because every little fart of an idea has been documented in perpetuity. But just as a thought experiment, how could we be kinder to future historians?
No, I think future historians have a glorious time. Because
today
we are documenting... May not be in a diary, but all of us are documenting our daily lives on social media.
Uh-huh.
What we ate, where we went, what are we seeing, which toothbrush we are using, everything. We put it up on some Insta story, Insta reel, and TikTok, and something else. Oh, it's banned in India. Yeah. So all these other things. So maybe these will become research material 100 years from now. So if someone in 24 is writing about the pandemic time and how did the world live through COVID-19. We are all the history the subjects of research then. So our Insta accounts, if they're still there, or some digital copy is lying in some ones and zeros somewhere, they'll become the research fodder for those historians I think we should be very careful and responsible on what we are posting, because they are going to be used as research material for future historians.
Yeah, if WhatsApp chats have become quote evidence, I can't imagine going to your bibliography if you still have those and writing Instagram archive pulled from that day where hashtag is written and there's a very nonsense photo and that's considered to be a major mover in some kind of a historic argument. It's going to be so ridiculous.
But it's a good thought to think of that 100 years from now, what would be the sources for a historian who's documenting this era of the era we are living in,
because who's probably not even born yet.
Yes, so we are thinking about his or her problems already. But he's not going to have a problem that someone like I have resurrecting the 18th century or 17th century, because those people didn't leave behind. And one of the reasons is this. And that somewhere explains to me why it's not such a bad thing that, we don't have a national sound archive. We feel that angst. I used to feel that angst. There's a cultural component there. A deep, it's embedded in our psyche. That it's probably very, very different. It's a different worldview. The way we look at the world, the Indic view, I think, is very different from the Western. While it is important to preserve, while it's important to document for posterity, That's not all. So even when one goes to a dance, Indian classical dance, or a music performance, the artist actually celebrating the destruction of it. You're creating a palace of music. Mm. You're creating this fantastic drama with all your, you know, bodily actions and all that. But you never wanted it to be documented and preserved and for posterity.
Mm.
You just live in the moment. You see that, you appreciate, oh, what a great performance. And then it dies. The palace, as it's building, by the end of the concert, the entire palace just crumbles down. And the person is going to walk out with memories. And so that's why our history has survived through anecdotal memories. So I will then tell, you know, in 1942, I heard Ustad so-and-so sing, Pandit so-and-so sing, and that was such a beautiful rag, Bhairavi, that he sang. And I'll add some embellishments to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll get further, you know, embellished. And that's how we are a nation of storytellers.
And then my attitudes will become the attitudes of the day.
Yeah. No, and we are a nation of storytellers. We add a lot of flourish to everything. How did our epics, the Ramayana, Mahabharata, every part of India adding its own story to it. Ram came here also. This is Sita's Rasoi. This is where, you know, his, you know, the imprints of Rama's, you know, feet are there. All kinds of things. There's one major story or concept of Sri Ram and Sita. But every part of India then added on to that. And then they made more and more additions. And so we, there is one core idea. And then through anecdotal memories, these get embellished, improvised, and we keep building over the core. And it starts assuming bigger, you know, reference points. And I think that's how knowledge transmission in this country, knowledge generation, knowledge transmission, maybe that's the modus in India.
Well, I hope after this conversation, when people listen to the Archive of Indian Music, they certainly will be forced to think about the transmission, because you have documented it. It's not like it's in your head or anyone else's head, or some of it is lying still in Chandni Chowk and many other chore bazaars, but most of it is there. How can people access it specifically? Do they go on SoundCloud and search Archive of Indian Music?
That's, yeah.
Just and search that?
Just search that, and it's free of cost. Sitting in the confines of your homes, this is the property of everybody, every Indian man, woman, child, who's listening to this. It's your ancestors' voices. So you have a right over it, and that's why it's freely accessible to everybody.
Amazing. Once again, thank you for your time, a second time, and it was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Vinamra. Great pleasure. Thank you.